Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to continue with our conversation with Josh Berkus. This conversation didn't have so much to do with PostgreSQL as much as it did with non-relational databases and some of the database ecosystem out there. And it was really, really interesting to kind of get the take on this from somebody who deals with and works with databases day in and day out. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. I do want to mention a few things here. First off, we are sponsored by New Relic. New Relic is an application management tool out there. It's on the web. It's super handy. Really gives you a good idea of what's going on with your app, where your problems are, and what you need to do to fix them. So if you're looking for something like that, go to newrelic.com. I want to let you know that I do a few other podcasts. I have the Ruby Rogues podcast. It's RubyRogues.com. And that's a conversation that I have with usually three to four other Ruby developers about just different things in the Ruby ecosystem and things like that. And the last conversation we had was about metaprogramming. I'm trying to remember what we're going to be talking about this afternoon, but it's escaping me. Anyway, so go check that out. I also do railscoach.com. If you're looking to learn Ruby on Rails and you want to just get a brief introduction to the concepts behind Ruby on Rails, then I do that. Those range from about 6 minutes to 10 minutes. I try and keep it to less than 10 minutes just so that, you know, people can kind of get a quick idea of what's there, and then they can go and explore more on their own. And finally, I do screencasts as well as this podcast on teachmetocode.com, and you can go and you can watch the videos. My last video was actually on Cassandra. It's an Apache project, and I actually happen to know the project lead or project director or whatever he is. He's a former coworker of mine. So anyway, you can go check all of those out. And if you're looking for specific help with Ruby or Rails, you know how to find me. Go to iTunes and leave us a review, and I'd appreciate that as well. I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to the interview, and I'll pick you up on the other side. Thanks. You can, for example, with MongoDB, there is a library called MongoMapper, and it's an ORM for MongoDB, and so you can just switch it in. But somebody else wrote that.
Yeah, see, that's the biggest problem that I have with MongoDB is that all of the interfaces are proprietary. You know, it's got its own query language. Uh-huh. It's got its own drivers that, you know, I mean, it's great that they put a lot of staff on creating drivers.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, they need to because you can't use anything else with it.
Right.
You know, the... And one of the things that I'm concerned about, you know, seeing some of the popularity that it's gotten, is that we're going to have a bunch of developers who are adopting MongoDB and then discover they can't get off of it.
Right.
Because, you know, you can always, like with Rails, you can always switch between MySQL and Postgres. There might be some adjustment. You know, and if some of these non-relational databases, if they could settle on a standard that's actually arbitrated by a third-party body, right, you know, then, you know, then you could have, you know, at least say among the document databases, you could have that level of portability, but they don't seem to be moving towards that. CouchDB has really made overtures towards establishing a standard, but none of the other non-relational databases have taken them up on it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I don't know. It would definitely make things easier in a lot of ways because, yeah, I mean, then you could switch between them. You could find the one that's the best fit and not be, you know, kind of crammed into one or the other. But yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know, because I imagine somebody, you know, they implement, you know, something that's going to be single server,
mm-hmm,
you know, on MongoDB, and then they discover they need durability. Like they want to take the application and put it on an appliance that has a power switch. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't do that with MongoDB.
Right.
You turn off the power, you've lost your database.
Mm-hmm.
So then they want to switch to, say, Couch.
Right.
And they discover they have to rewrite the whole application.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the database business for 20 years, yeah, and this is how it used to be before SQL. I mean, it's one of the reasons why the SQL standard was such a great thing. for databases, because whatever its flaws were, it is an international standard, and everybody pays lip service to it, regardless of how good their implementations are. And the thing is, before we had that, we had a bunch of relational and non-relational databases, and they all had proprietary interfaces. And I mean, talk to the health department sometime. They're wedded to cache, and they cannot get off of it. They funded like an open source project with a major amount of money, but the goal of the open source project was effectively to reproduce cache's interface in its entirety, which they can't really do because cache would sue them. You know, there you get into things that are eminently patentable. And they have to reproduce it, including the bugs, is the big issue. You know?
Oh, man.
Because when you have a proprietary interface, you can't tell the difference between a feature and a bug. And I think we're going to see over the next few years, we're going to see a replay of that again, you know, where a bunch of developers build big applications based on a particular non-relational database and then discover that the lack of portability is a disaster.
Right. So do you think there might come out some kind of intermediary library that you feed the data into, and then it's smart enough to say, well, I'm talking to Couch, so I'll send it Couch's way? Or,
well, it'd be very hard because the whole model of how to interface with the database is completely different.
Right.
Actually, bizarrely enough, MongoDB has made that easier because they have in their documentation basically a mapping of their proprietary query language to SQL queries. Which is amusing, and it shows you the problem with a proprietary query language today is that you have to basically compare it to SQL.
That's true.
Because otherwise nobody will understand it. So, you could, but the thing is, if there's not some sort of core standardization, like if we can't turn, if we can't come up with something JSON, Bisonish, or whatever, mm-hmm. that has an international standard and has a certain set of attributes, a certain set of features that's standard across the industry, then making anything like that work is going to be very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
If not downright impossible.
Huh. So do you think, do you really think that they're going to come to the point where they will standardize on an interface?
I don't know. It's hard to believe that. I mean, because the problem is that right now for document databases, the one that has all of the PR momentum is MongoDB.
Right.
And they are aggressively hostile to other database systems.
Right.
So the idea of them collaborating with anybody else seems fairly far-fetched.
Uh-huh.
For example, we hold this biannual thing, OpenDB, the Open Database Summit, where developers from lots of databases, relational, non-relational, meet in an academic environment to talk about issues with database development. And I see basically people on every other open source database there at one or the other, except MongoDB. They don't show up for it.
Huh.
The only one they'll show up for is NoSQLCon, which they sponsor and dominate the program of. And the thing is, it doesn't have to be. I mean, it absolutely doesn't have to be that way. But this comes down to sort of a company thing. The people who run the company feel that, you know, and so far have been right, that being belligerent and on the attack against all other database systems is a good business model.
Right.
And that gets pushed down to the engineers. I bet there are engineers at MongoDB who would like to go to OpenDBCon, and they're not allowed to.
Where do you think this is all heading then? Because like you said, I mean, it is kind of like what we were facing, 15 years ago, 20 years ago with the now SQL database, most of the standard engines. Do you think that some of the others might pull together and put together some kind of standard?
Yeah, some of it happens. I mean, a lot of it is going to depend on what sort of happens in the future and in what timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, I would say, looking at the company, TenGen, et cetera, I feel like they're headed for a MySQL-style meltdown. And the question is how quickly that happens and how many users they have when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
If they have enough users, as MySQL has proven, the meltdown won't matter for the open source product, except that, and this is very important, MongoDB is AGPL, which makes the ability of anybody to commercially support it other than TenGen pretty much negligible.
Oh, man.
You know, as in, like, you're not going to see Heroku using MongoDB because that requires Heroku to open source their entire infrastructure.
Right.
You know, except that they license it from TenGen. And then if something happens to TenGen, that's the end of that business model.
Right.
So, you know, it's the same reason why I used to see completely inappropriate vendors adopting Postgres over MySQL was because of that whole dual licensing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give you an example of what I mean by completely inappropriate. It included, like, television set-top boxes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Postgres is a big server database. It's
right.
Not designed for, you know, a little tiny system with 128 megs of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
And a gigabyte of storage.
So what is the licensing on Postgres?
It's the PostgreSQL license.
Okay.
Which is essentially a different format of the BSD license,
uh-huh.
Which says, use it for any purpose you want to, just don't sue us.
I can live with that.
Yeah, so, and that's resulted in the whole sort of ecosystem around Postgres, where you have companies that create proprietary extensions to Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
You know, GreenPlum, MasterData, EnterpriseDB, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And, you know, that has some disadvantages in that people are doing innovation on Postgres that never gets contributed to the database.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it also allows, you know, you don't see other database systems having this level of commercial innovation built on top of them.
Right.
Because, you know, because like for MySQL, for example, you can't touch the database engine without having a license from some company. Something that a lot of storage engine vendors right now are desperately regretting now that Oracle controls the IP.
Right. So what is the licensing on MySQL?
So MySQL is still GPL version 2.
Okay.
And that is less of a constraint than it used to be because Drizzle has released a differently licensed core driver for Drizzle, which happens to work with MySQL.
Uh-huh.
At least up through version 5.1, I think. So as a result, you no longer have the problem that you're forced to use a GPL driver, which then attaches a bunch of your other code to the GPL.
Right.
So that becomes a sort of clean interface layer if you use that alternate driver.
Mm-hmm.
But some things like storage engines, for example, do have to touch the internals of MySQL in order to work, in order to even function.
Right.
And so those, you know, if you're going to implement a storage engine for MySQL, you either have to use GPL version 2 or you have to have a commercial engine license.
Right, which the commercial engine license basically removes the GPL so you don't have to open source your stuff.
Right. But that means that you're paying license fees to Oracle.
Right.
And Oracle has a really strong history of destroying its licensors when it decides it wants to compete with them.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine I'm Infobright. So I make a data warehousing storage engine for MySQL.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you think Oracle wants Infobright to succeed?
Nope. No, because they have their own suite of products that do the same thing.
Yes. Yeah, Infobright is directly a competitor with some of Oracle's products.
Yep.
So Oracle is going to license MySQL to Infobright either on really disadvantageous terms, or given Oracle's history, they're going to come up with ways to jerk them around that destroys their business.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, they're going to wait until – they're just going to stall them until after their commercial license expires and force mm-hmm. them to stop shipping for 6 weeks. And then say, I'm sorry, I can't imagine how that would have happened.
Oh, God. So basically they're being anti-competitive because they own the intellectual property.
They're looking out for their own interests.
Yeah.
They happen to have acquired the intellectual property. Yeah. And they didn't look, they didn't pay whatever it was, $11 billion for Sun out of altruism.
No, of course not.
They paid that amount of money because they expected to deliver for Oracle.
Uh-huh.
And eliminating the part of the MySQL community that competes with Oracle is part of that goal. They want to retain part of the MySQL community. They want to retain the part that doesn't compete with Oracle,
right?
Which exists. But they don't want to retain some of the things like the alternate storage engines and stuff that really cut into the Oracle business. So
where do you think this is going to go in the long run? Because, I mean, this kind of behavior isn't only going to affect the people who are competing with Oracle. I mean, it's going to affect anybody who's using MySQL to a certain degree.
Yeah. Well, so some of, yeah, it's, well, I mean, the thing is, though, if you're using core MySQL, so using MySQL, InnoDB, and that sort of thing, so far you're in pretty good shape with Oracle.
Right.
I mean, they've been basically fixing bugs. If you look at the 5.5 and 5.6 releases, they're fixing a lot of bugs that have been in the MySQL bug database for like 6 years.
Oh, wow.
And that's why those data, that's why those releases are so feature free,
mm-hmm.
is because some of those bugs are actually really bad flaws that have been around for a long time.
Right.
And they've been doing that. They finally made InnoDB the default storage engine, something that should have happened years ago.
I can vouch for that. We did a whole bunch of geographical stuff at my last job, and we couldn't store it in the default engine. We had to switch it over.
Yeah, so for core MySQL, I mean, they've really been sort of delivering on that. The problem is the worry about what's going to happen in the future. You know, what's going to happen when Oracle sales staff actually report a conflict between, because one of the things we've already seen is they have dramatically raised the support and commercial licensing prices for MySQL.
Right.
And the thing is, even with a dramatic raise, they are still, you know, a 20th of what it costs for Oracle.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that, you know, what happens if you're the head of an Oracle sales office and a customer has an application where you could use Oracle or you could use MySQL?
Right.
And the customer pushes you into choosing the much cheaper MySQL.
Right.
Well, what do you think that sales office head is going to say to Redwood City?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this has happened with a lot of other companies where they suddenly, for whatever reason, have a less expensive option with market overlap with one of their core products. And no matter how good the intentions are, and Oracle has actually shown a lot of evidence of good intentions as far as MySQL is concerned, no matter how good the intentions are, what inevitably ends up happening is the less expensive product line ends up being sidelined and eventually destroyed.
Oh, God.
Because a company, look, the purpose of a company is to deliver to its stockholders.
Right.
And Oracle is in a particularly tight spot where they have made promises to a lot of big stockholders that the stock will not go down. Even temporarily. So even if, for example, it made sense for Oracle 5 years from now to pull a lot of resources, you know, to really push MySQL to their customer base, they can't afford to do it. They can't afford to have losses for one quarter even, because when they do, their stockholders will vote out the board.
Wow.
So that's the problem with a publicly traded company, particularly one with a history of stock market success, is that you get very fickle stockholders who do not understand temporary losses for strategic gains. Microsoft has been through the same thing with this.
Right. So you supported MSSQL for a while.
Yeah.
What made you switch over to Postgres? Because we're talking like, what, 10 years ago or something?
Yeah. There's a lot of reasons. The number one reason was that I was doing small business solutions. Like I wrote a piece of temp agency software, for example. And when Microsoft first posted the release of Microsoft up through SQL Server 7, pricing for Microsoft for both Windows NT 4 and SQL Server had actually been quite affordable. Like, I could deploy a server with all of the software on it for like $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when SQL Server 2000 and Windows 2000 were first announced, the pricing that was announced was quintuple that.
Oh, wow.
Well, given that I was only charging my clients $10,000 for the software,
uh-huh,
for the software I was selling them with a year of support,
uh-huh,
I could not afford to be shelling out $7,000 for the platform.
Right.
That effectively almost doubled the cost of my solution for the clients and would have caused them to go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the problem to begin with. The second problem was support, which was Windows NT was crashy. Microsoft SQL Server 7 was crashy.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered that for my average temp agency client, I was in there once every 3 weeks just keeping it up and running.
Wow.
That just was not a sustainable business model for a three-person company.
Mm-hmm.
And also because the Microsoft remote access story was a disaster. So I couldn't access the stuff by remote to fix it. I had to go there in the office, right? So what happened with the last straw was in 2008, a friend of mine actually, one of my clients actually introduced me to Linux. Mm-hmm. And I got interested in Linux. And I was like, oh, well, if Linux is out there, there must be an open source database. I looked at MySQL. But at the time, MySQL didn't even do joins. And uh-huh. I was an SQL expert. So I'm like, I want something with joins and subqueries and calculated expressions and all of these other things I'm used to using.
Right.
And I found this Postgres project. So an interesting thing happened in a week in 2008. I discovered bugs in two different databases. I discovered a bug in SQL implementation in Postgres, something that didn't work the way that it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered a data loss bug in SQL Server 7. A pretty substantial one, actually. One that people could trip across by accident and lose their data and not be aware that it was missing. You didn't get an error message mm-hmm. or anything. The data just disappeared.
Right. You would know it was gone when you went to find it.
Yes. So I posted that on the MSDN forums. I said, mm-hmm. I found this particular issue, that sort of thing. And bizarrely, my post disappeared. Nobody contacted me from Microsoft. My post just vanished off of the public forums.
Maybe they were storing it in SQL Server.
Right. And yeah, possibly. So then I posted it a second time.
Uh-huh.
And I got a direct email from somebody at Microsoft that said, if you keep spreading this misinformation, your MSDN subscription, which I paid $2,000 a year for, will be suspended without refund.
Oh, wow.
So I reported a bug on SQL Server, a major bug on SQL Server 7. And I was threatened with censure by Microsoft. And by the way, that bug was never fixed. I mean, it was corrected in SQL Server 2000, but it was never fixed in SQL Server 7, which, a lot of people continued to use for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
losing data. So that same month, I discovered this SQL bug where this particular, I don't even remember what it was, but some piece of SQL syntax did not work at all the way it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And I post it on one of the PostgreSQL mailing lists. And Tom Lane, who actually had only joined the project 3 months before me, but had a long experience with open source through other things.
Uh-huh.
This is on a Sunday, right? So on a Sunday morning, I post this bug for PostgreSQL.
Uh-huh.
By like 11 a.m. on Sunday morning, I have an email from Tom Lane saying, you're right, that's broken. Here's a patch. See if it fixes it. Which then immediately threw me into this because I was used to being a Microsoft programmer. I'm like, what's a patch? What do I do with a patch? So I spent the entire next weekend figuring out how to actually build stuff from source with a patch. But it was a completely different experience, and it showed you the difference between dealing with proprietary software and dealing with open source, right?
Right.
And that's true today with Postgres. If you find an actual bug, you post that, somebody say, ah, crap, that's broken. Here's what we're going to do to fix it. And depending on what the bug is, there might be a really longish argument and discussion about how to fix it. But nobody's going to ignore it. Nobody's going to pretend that you're not an important enough user, If it's a bug, it's a bug, regardless of who reported it. Mm-hmm. Unlike a proprietary software company where the immediate thing that happens if you report a hard-to-fix bug, what happens is it goes over to the sales department, and the sales department says, well, how much is this customer paying us? and if it's not enough, they don't fix the bug.
The reason I'm laughing is because, let's see, how long has it been? Like 5 years, 6 years? I was the technical support director at a company here in Utah. And we would get reports of bugs, legitimate bugs. And I mean, if we could reproduce it, then generally they'd accept, okay, this is a bug. But yeah, it was amazing how many of those got prioritized by the amount of money that the person who was reporting it was spending with us. And it was also amazing to me how many of them were, if it seemed hard, it was just, oh, that's not a bug. That's not a bug. You know, and we would explain it. We would try and sell it. You know, we would reproduce it. But if it meant major changes to the system,
yeah,
no way, man.
My favorite quote from another proprietary software vendor, this is Elite Legal Billing System, which at the time ran on SQL Server and was the source of most of my business. Mm-hmm. By coincidence, actually, the source of most of the business of another core team member. He even worked on a project that I had, and we didn't have any direct contact with each other at the time, which was funny. My favorite quote from them is, I report something that was clearly, there was a feature for being able to split expenses mm-hmm. between clients.
Okay.
But the thing was that no matter what you did, at the end of your session, the expense did not end up split. It was just, there was no way to actually save your work.
Okay.
So I report this bug. And the response I get back was, it's not a bug. It's working the way the developer intended it to work.
Oh, I hate those two. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, that was the quote. And I'm like, what the hell? It's like, why do I care what the developer intended? I care what the customer wants.
Yeah, no kidding.
It doesn't do what the customer wants. It doesn't do what the feature is named even.
Right.
And therefore, it is a bug, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you regard this as a feature request, then put it in. And in this particular case, this particular customer was like their fifth largest customer too. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even a not enough money situation. It was a situation of something that proprietary vendors work, which is if we put up enough resistance, the customer will learn to work around it and we don't have to fix it. Unfortunately, that was also the attitude at MySQL AB for many years.
Uh-huh.
I had a truly frightening month at Sun where I was in charge of the MySQL bug list, which is an illusion shattering experience if you've ever had one, which is why I have so much sympathy for Oracle now, because I know what that bug list looks like.
Uh-huh.
And you know, there was this policy that if a bug hadn't been fixed for 2 years, then users had obviously learned to work around it.
Right, because that's definitely the right approach. I mean, you know, if they figured out how to work around it, then why should we waste our time on it?
Yeah. So, now, I mean, not that we don't have issues in Postgres, because there's definite disputes over, for example, whether or not something is a bug.
Right.
Particularly if the bug really comes down to a usability issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things is that, you know, we do have people who are effectively full-time developers on Postgres, and so they haven't really worked on an application. They haven't personally worked on a software application for years, maybe mm-hmm. not ever. And so often explaining usability issues to them requires a lot of email back and forth because they just don't understand why it's a problem.
Right.
You know? We occasionally have issues with you know, things, and we do have, like every other open source project, we occasionally have issues with things that really are bugs sort of getting lost.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was a plan to fix it. You know, we were going to fix it in the next major release, and somehow it got lost. And there was a problem with the fix, and it got kicked back to the person who wrote the fix, who was on vacation, and then sort of disappeared.
Yeah, but you're talking about management issues that occur in any large project with more than a handful of developers working on it.
Yeah, I don't want to pretend that we're perfect, particularly right. if I'm criticizing somebody like MySQL. And specifically, actually, I'm criticizing their MySQL AB. Mm-hmm. Because that was not a decision of the engineers not to fix these things. That was right. a decision of corporate management. The engineers would have been happy to fix these issues. Many of them wrote fixes for these issues, which were then not applied for various reasons.
Right. Huh.
So the what's the problem when, you know, and this is something I would warn everybody who's running a startup out there. Be careful when you accept venture capital and how you accept it, because the venture capitalists are in it for the money, and they're in it for the money on an extremely short-term basis.
Uh-huh.
So if, they don't care what happens to the company after it's sold or after it IPOs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to remember when you're dealing with VCs.
Right. So that leads me into a whole different realm that I'm a little curious on. As far as running a startup or whatever, have you been involved in a startup? I guess you started the Postgres Experts.
Yeah, I mean, that's a consulting company. So we're services. We didn't take any outside money. We didn't even take a loan, actually. So, right.
Well, you start getting paid as soon as you start running services, more or less.
Right, yeah. It would have been useful to have some startup capital, but not useful enough for us to take the strings attached.
Right.
Even loan payments. I don't know, maybe actually if I was going back 2 years again and doing it again, I might actually take a small business loan.
Right.
Because just having, like, say, $100,000, as it turns out, we could have paid it off relatively easily, and having that money up front would have helped us do a lot of things a little bit faster. But mm-hmm. didn't do it. Not having to pay for it now, so that's nice. For example, I was involved in Greenplum for the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my most recent startup, and actually the most benevolent startup experience, because Greenplum, as you know, did fairly well. And we had good VCs. Never really had a problem with the VCs at Greenplum.
Mm-hmm.
My prior startup experience, and the reason why I wasn't involved with a lot of web startups, you know, when everyone else was, mm-hmm. was I was involved in one of the very earliest dot-coms, which was a company called iPro. iPro created the first ad view tracking software for web browsers. It's actually and sort of viewership software for websites. Mm-hmm. It's actually, at least algorithmically, their software still forms the core of what Alexa uses, if you're familiar with Alexa.
Yep.
But the problem was that, like many early startups, the person who was the chief engineer was also the CEO.
Right.
This was a disaster. During the time I was involved with them, that year, in a 9-month period, which was the period of my contact with them, although I was only actually employed for a couple of months,
mm-hmm.
They actually, I think their average turnover per position at the company was 300%.
Wow.
Yeah. And on top of which, I realized what a disaster it was, because what I was doing there was I was writing their sales software, because at the time there was nothing they could buy. Uh-huh. That would do their sales. So I wrote a sales software package for them. And by the time I finished writing it, once we got data into it, I realized that they were losing an average of $3,000 per customer just on paper.
Wow. Holy cow.
Because it was – they basically charged customers like $1,000, mm-hmm. and it cost them $4,000 to provide the services they were charging right. the customers for. So the so I'm like, how does this work exactly? Wasn't until years later that a friend of mine at Pets.com, well, not a friend of mine, but somebody at Pets.com came up with a quote for that, which you probably know. The we lose money in every sale, but we'll make it up in volume.
Mm-hmm.
but anyway, it was a disastrous experience. I ended up quitting with a substantial amount of money owed to me, which I really couldn't afford at the time, that I was never able to collect.
Right.
So it was a really... disastrous experience for me, which is when I moved into legal services software, because it was a much safer market.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, wasn't part of a champion.com, didn't manage to, you know, make $1 million off of Google or something. But on the other hand, I never showed up for work to find the doors chained shut either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the so that's been sort of that. Now my experience with startups is a lot more secondhand. I would say about half of our clients are startups.
Right.
And you know, and the thing is, when you work on somebody's database system, you're involved in their business.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
So we end up actually getting sort of intimately involved with what their delivery dates, et cetera, are. You know, when do you need this to work by? You know, and even advising them in development strategy. I say, look, do you actually need this for version one? You know, if you don't need this for version one, let's not develop it. Because there might not be a version two, you know?
Yeah. Well, I do a lot of that with my clients. Do you really need that in there?
Yes,
we really need it. Are you sure? Because, you know.
The really funny thing is I have really mixed feelings about agile development. Uh-huh. And it's bizarre to today be in a position of preaching being at least a little bit more agile to our clients, to be saying to them, look, you know, until you actually have customers, you don't actually know how useful any of this is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So let's try to implement the minimum feature set and then get some feedback from our customers.
Mm-hmm.
From your customers.
Right.
Because otherwise, you're going to waste a lot of time and money developing a feature that is going to turn out nobody wants.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and, you know, I see that a lot with my customers, too, or with my clients. You know, I'm a freelance developer, and I see a lot of that where it's, well, we need this and this and this and this. And, you know, sometimes you can talk them around it, and sometimes you can't. And, you know...
Yeah, I actually forgot something in our earlier conversation about another reason actually for Rails developers to use Postgres.
That's fine.
You're still recording this, so you can splice it in.
Uh-huh.
Transactional DDL.
What's
so
that?
All database structure changes in Postgres are transactional, except for create database. So create table, alter table, drop table, add column. Drop constraint, even truncate, these are all transaction safe. And that means that you can do migrations at runtime.
Wow.
So, and that's just not true with MySQL in ODB. In ODB has basically you pretty much have to call a downtime anytime you're going to want to do a deployment that makes changes to the database structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are obviously things that do exclusive locking or have heavy I/O costs when you're doing migrations. So you still want to do a test and find out what the impact is.
Right.
But in a lot of cases, I can do, you know, because we're doing this for, you know, clients who are now in the rapid deployment model, as a lot of people are now. You know, and, you know, they're doing deployments every week. And it's like I look at their set of changes and they're like, so do we need a downtime for that? And I'm like, no. No, just run it. Keep an eye on it. See whether or not, you know, queries are piling up because of locks and maybe cancel it and run it again. But that's it. You know, otherwise, don't worry about it. You don't need to shut it down. You don't need to shut the application off. It'll just work.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly for Rails developers, that's really nice because you don't want to shut your site down for the migrations.
Right.
That's
typically now, what's done, though.
Yeah, and you need to do a lot of testing. I found that the built-in Active Record, the Rails migration code, doesn't pay a lot of attention to data retention.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's relatively easy to innocently do things that you think are incremental changes that wipe out an entire table.
Yeah.
So, you need to run it through testing. But... you know, beyond, which is actually true anytime you're doing any kind of migration, whether it's ad hoc or Rails or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, the possibility that a lot of these migrations can be deployed at runtime without a downtime is very attractive.
Mm-hmm. That's really true. So I've been recording this whole thing. If you're not...
I haven't said anything I don't want to be quoted on.
Okay. That's what I was going to ask is I might just release this as a two-parter.
Yeah, the second part is a little bit wide ranging, but yeah.
No, that's fine. I think a lot of the stuff that you've gone over though is interesting, and you know, things that my audience would be interested in hearing. So I think that'll be fine.
Okay. Well, good. Well, that's been fun.
It has been fun.
You have anything else you'd like to ask me while I'm here?
I'm going to hang up and call you right back again because we're getting that static again.
Okay.
So I guess I am a little curious, too, then, about your experience with some of the non-relational databases. Have you found some that do seem to work better than others? Or?
Oh, so can you hear me fine? Because you're fading out for me.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, well, then I won't worry about it. So I have my favorites, and keep in mind that I'm approaching them from a database developer's perspective.
Uh-huh.
So I tend to be a lot more interested in databases that implement interesting things than necessarily, although some of them have proved to be extremely useful. So CouchDB, which was obviously the first non-relational database that I used in production with Postgres is Memcached.
Right.
Which everybody uses because it works.
Yeah.
The more recent crop of non-relational databases, CouchDB,
uh-huh.
Which I used for government open data, because for CouchDB, the ability to do multi-master asynchronous sharing of data is built into the platform.
Right.
And Postgres has that through like the Bucardo project, but it's very much an add-on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot more complicated for people to participate in the sharing than it is for CouchDB.
Mm-hmm.
So in a case of where we're doing like San Francisco government open data and we want people to be able to download stuff, modify it, and upload their changes, CouchDB was actually great for that.
Mm-hmm.
I use a lot of Redis currently.
Okay.
It's great for lightweight queuing. It's much less complicated to implement than like RabbitMQ.
Uh-huh.
Plus, frankly, I don't write Java, all of the whole everything that implements MQ seems to be written in Java and require Java interfaces. I end up preferring to use Redis just because I can address Redis via Python and Perl, which I'm more comfortable with.
Uh-huh.
Plus, Redis, from the perspective of a database developer, Redis implements some very interesting things that are the sort of thing that as a database developer you would kick around and say, what if we build a database that does X?
Uh-huh.
And Salvatore has done that. He's implemented basically what is effectively sort of a SQL-free quasi-relational database with assorted sets and stuff. It's sort of a it's actually a set theory database almost in the way that it's implemented.
Right.
And it's almost accidental that it turns out to be as useful as it is, which it is.
Uh-huh.
The other one that I've gotten involved with, the other ones that I've gotten involved with a lot lately are the enterprise search things. So Solr and Elasticsearch.
Right.
And that's because I work in the realm of data warehousing.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that enterprise search is actually implements sort of a lightweight column store feature set and sort of a lightweight data mining feature set,
mm-hmm.
to the point where there actually are a fair number, there are real world data warehousing applications that actually where that fits.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously using these things that are open source and free are much cheaper for companies and also easier to implement than the heavyweight things I might do for larger clients like Green Plum, mm-hmm. Vertica, AstroData sort of things. I've been sort of pulled into that in the sort of world of non-relational databases. I mean, the thing is with the current crop of non-relational databases, what you've got is a bunch of databases that don't do a lot of things at all, but mm-hmm. they have a few things that they do really, really well.
Right.
And really well from two perspectives. One is from a perspective of, you know, sort of performance and feature set, but also from perspective of ease of use. That is, you know, I'll run into things where, yes, because Postgres is the extensible database, yes, I could do them in Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
But if they hit the sweet spot for the specific new database, it's much easier to implement them in that new database and then deal with the integration problems. And that's, that was one of the other big Postgres features.
Mm-hmm.
Big feature. and I'm sorry I didn't mention it earlier, foreign data wrappers. So the idea of a foreign data wrapper is you write a driver for an external data source,
mm-hmm.
and it can be anything which is capable of returning data in a tabular format.
Mm-hmm.
And you create an object, and then that object behaves like a table. So that external data source could be a MySQL database, it could be a CouchDB database, mm-hmm. it could be a spreadsheet, it could be a Lucene database.
Mm-hmm.
So then Postgres actually becomes an integration tool because, say, you've got all this transactional data, like you have all your customer transactions you've got there in Postgres, but you've got this huge search thing that you're doing, and that's in Solr. So what you do is, instead of pumping that all through your middleware code,
mm-hmm.
you add a foreign data wrapper for Solr, and then you can query, you can run your searches directly from Postgres. And so from the perspective of your application, it's still a single database interface. But under the hood, you actually are using multiple databases.
That is slick.
Yeah, and actually that's been – I thought that was going to be a hard concept for people to grab. But 9.1 isn't even out yet, and we've already had people release 7 different foreign data wrapper drivers for it.
Wow.
I mean, people are really excited about this. So, yeah. So – that's a big thing, and I actually see, you know, again, because Postgres is the database about doing things inside the database, I can see uh-huh. us actually operating in a much bigger integration role in the future because we have all of these new non-relational databases, which basically they're one, in a lot of cases, they're one trick or two trick ponies.
Mm-hmm.
So they do their tricks really, really well, but then they can't do anything else, you know?
Right.
And so then you've got this whole integration picture, right? I mean, like one workspace I know of, one client that we work with has PostgreSQL, MySQL, Elasticsearch, Hadoop HBase, and Memcached.
Wow.
All in the same application. So at that point, integration becomes a major development and administrative overhead.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I think with foreign data wrappers, we can actually reduce that cost of administration for having all of these different data sources a lot, you know, to the point where you can actually say this, and also make it easier. Unfortunately, in version 1 and 9.1, foreign data wrappers are read-only.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully in future versions, they will be read-write.
Right.
There are issues to work out with that we didn't want to do in 9.1 because there are some kinds of data sources that obviously have to be read-only.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start writing to foreign data wrappers, you have the issue of, you know, Postgres is a transactional database. What if you're pumping data to a non-transactional database? What happens when you roll back a transaction?
Right.
That we didn't want to deal with quite yet, but it'll be coming in the future because people want it.
That is amazing. That is honestly just
yeah.
even the read only though is just you know.
But for the rest of to actually do sort of a rundown of the rest of the sort of non-relational databases. So those are the ones I've been using.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole set of non-relational databases that are designed for sort of transactional scaling.
Mm-hmm.
That is serving a very broad number of transactions across a cluster at the same time. And here I would include things like Cassandra. And Voldemort, and the new MongoDB, and a variety of other Hypertable and that sort of thing. And I just haven't had to use any of these directly.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a couple that are in use that are clients. One of the problems there is that MongoDB was originally the least technically advanced of those.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the one with the best funding situation. Because Cassandra has currently been cut adrift and no longer has a project funder,
right?
Or funder, major funders of any kind, and React actually has a funder, but they're not as well set up as TenGen is.
Uh-huh.
So I don't really know all that's happening with React in that regard. I don't know anyone who uses Voldemort outside of LinkedIn. I mean, I think actually one of the problems that we're having with all those, these are what I call the cap theorem databases, because a lot of them actually built their sort of theoretical foundations around the Amazon cap theorem papers.
Uh-huh.
The concept isn't new. It dates back to the telecom databases of the early 80s. And as a matter of fact, I know some people, older database engineers who worked on telecom databases in the 80s, who have now found new lucrative employment with startups. Uh-huh. Working on cap theorem databases, But I think we got too many of them. I think the problem was, because if you look at any of these projects, they have a tiny handful of database engineers working on them. And I think it would be a lot better shape if, honestly, if there were less of them. That is, when a couple of them drop off the radar, you know, like say for whatever reason Cassandra falls apart completely, and the Cassandra engineers go to work on React, if that happened, I think we'd actually be in better shape of getting something that actually delivered on all the features you want out of that kind of a database.
Right.
You know, my experience from listening to my clients about those databases is they're beautiful in terms of the number of transactions they can process. They are really, really problematic in terms of reliability and the amount of administration it takes to keep them running.
Right.
That is, you know, if you're going to deploy a Cassandra cluster or something, you'd better have a dedicated staff of engineers to keep that up. a lot of that is a function of how old the databases are and how mature they are. In that, you know, like I know people who worked on some of the older telecom databases, and those took 10 years to reach the level of maturity where they were reliable enough to be used in production. I think open source moves a little faster, but, you know, the Cassandra project is, what, 3 years old?
Right.
Now the bizarre one there is the new MongoDB, because the original MongoDB was conceived of as basically what amounts to a crap database. Had no durability, had no ability to keep data, had only asynchronous replication and that sort of thing. After TenGen got off to a running start, though, they hired lots of new engineering staff, some very experienced people, who have been re-implementing MongoDB as a real cap theorem database with, you know, with peer-to-peer multi-node replication for durability and that sort of thing.
Right.
So one of the things I could conceivably see happening is, if TenGen could get over what appears to be hostility towards learning anything from any other database system, that, you know, they can take something that was a toy and turn it into a really strong database. I mean, I have to remember when MySQL was first released, it was also a toy. It was not, you know, it would crash and eat your data. It didn't do joins. It was not, you know, you couldn't have more than three sessions at a time, you know, a whole bunch of other things. You know, a lot of things start out that way. Postgres didn't start out as a toy, but it did start out as being impossible to install and impossible to keep running. So the, you know, so I mean, everybody starts sort of back there. And, and I could conceive of a future actually where, you know, in, you know, three versions, four versions of MongoDB down the road, it's a really competitive solution for that kind of database, even among people who really know databases. It's not impossible. It's been done before. So for other, they do need to change the name, though. I mean, while I'm grateful to MongoDB from taking the mantle of worst database name away from us, away from Postgres, it is a fundamental problem in getting anybody to take it seriously.
That's true.
You know, they can't even promote it in Scandinavia.
Why is that?
Because in Scandinavia, the word Mongo is the kind of insult you get sent to detention in school for using.
Oh.
Yeah. It would be like, it would be like if I released something called Dickwad DB, you know. It might have a certain underground popularity, but you could never actually get anybody to adopt it officially. The for other databases, VaultDB is very interesting from a database developer perspective. I'm not going to – it would be a fairly longish explanation of what's special about it. But the problem that I see with VaultDB is who is going to be their users.
Right.
Because in order to run an application in VaultDB, it has to have been written from the ground up for VaultDB. And that seems like a very narrow use case. Like, I can imagine them becoming one of these sort of niche industry databases where, you know, a few, like a specific industry uses VaultDB, like Cache, for example. Specific industry uses VaultDB for a whole variety of things, and they have a sort of permanent customer base there. But it never spreads beyond that because it's too hard to... You can't port something to VaultDB.
Right.
You know. What else have we got? The whole Hadoop HBase business is a completely different department. Mm-hmm. So that's large-scale data mining.
Right.
And it's great for that. It's fantastic. I mean, it provides a really good alternative to the very expensive, very large-scale data warehousing databases. Mm-hmm. So a real choice there is Hadoop HBase versus, say, Greenplum, Aster Data, et cetera. And the older proprietary data warehousing databases have more features and are less require less engineering for you to implement them. Mm-hmm. But they're also very, very expensive, particularly for large deployments with dozens of nodes.
Right.
So, you know, and Hadoop is more of a construction kit. It's actually a development platform. It's not really a thing at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you have the engineering talent, and this is particularly true of startups, you can implement some very scalable data searches, et cetera, on it, you know, and data mining and that sort of thing. I think HBase is a long way to go in the reliability department, having had some experience with it in that regard. But then it is only 2 years old, so that's not surprising. I mean, heck, it just like last month graduated out of the Apache incubator, I believe.
Right.
So I think I've covered actually most of the new non-relational databases.
I think you have too.
I mean, there are others. There are lots of others out there, but they're mostly analogs of some of the databases I've already talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Well, I really need to wrap this up and get on to other things. Okay. But this was honestly a really, really fun conversation to have and really interesting things that I've learned and that I'm going to go have to learn more about. So, you know, thanks again for spending the time and sharing your opinions and your thoughts, because, man, I mean, there's a lot there, a lot to unpack, and, you know, definitely some things that, like I said, I'm going to have to go and learn a little more about.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, I really enjoy working in the database world. I like databases. Uh-huh. That's why I do it. And it's even more fun now because the database world has gotten so much more exciting in the last 2 years than it was in the decade before that.
Yeah, it got really interesting really fast, didn't it?
Yeah. So, okay, well, thanks a lot, and it's been good talking to you.
Yeah, you too. We'll talk to you later. All right, we're back. Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. I really appreciate it. I'm putting up a survey. I keep saying that. I'm serious this time. My virtual assistant is putting it up as we speak. The survey will be at teachmetocode.com/survey. And it's just basically to help me get an idea of who's out there and what you're about, where you're at. And so I would really appreciate the input that you have there. And anyway, that'll give me an idea and help me find some sponsors, so I would really, really appreciate that. I have no intention of ever charging for the podcast. It's not something that I've even considered, but at the same time, it does cost money to put this out, and so any help like that would be terrific. Also, please go into iTunes and leave a review. You can find us if you search for teachmetocode.com. You'll also find the screencast there. Go watch a few and tell me what you think. And other than that, if you need help with your Ruby or Rails application, or if you're working with Sinatra or one of the other frameworks out there, I am willing and able to help you out. Just give me a call at 801-367-6164, and we'll go ahead and figure out what you're trying to do and see if we can make it happen for you. All right, thanks.